Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good Thursday afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 with Mark. I'm Steve. In Valley traffic, accidents on the 101 northbound in the East Valley at Broadway. And if you're heading northbound, there's a collision on the 101 as well at Frank Lloyd Wright Boulevard. Valley weather for the rest of today, we're showing a 70% chance of some more rain. And then for tonight, that chance becomes 40% when our lows should be around 50. And then by the time that Saturday rolls around, 90% chance for rain. Currently, relative humidity at 65%, and it's 64 degrees at KJZZ.
Big changes are in store for Arizonans who put solar panels on their homes. This week, regulators voted to change how those customers are compensated for the power they produce. Many in the solar industry say the decision could stall the growth of this technology in Arizona, which is one of the top markets in the country. KJZZ's Will Stone covers energy, and he joins me. So, Will, how exactly does this decision change the way solar customers will be billed?
Put simply, Mark, it will reduce their savings. Up till now, rooftop solar customers who are hooked up to the grid, they get credited by utilities for the extra power they produce. It's called net metering. And what's really key about this is that they get reimbursed at retail rates, meaning it's the same amount they get charged by the utility for the time when they need energy, when the sun isn't shining. So this week, the Arizona Corporation Commission, which regulates utilities, decided the solar customers should get compensated less than the retail rate. And instead, going forward, the prices they get paid will be based on two possible formulas. The first is what utilities pay for energy from large-scale solar farms. That's basically the wholesale market. And the second will be based on a complex formula that takes into account the avoided costs, such as transmission lines, fuel costs, the things that utilities don't have to spend money on because people are producing their own power locally. But in either case, customers who have rooftop solar will be getting less for their power.
So, Will, does this affect people who already have rooftop solar systems installed?
No. And this was seen as a bright spot in what was otherwise not a very favorable decision in the eyes of many solar advocates. Existing customers will be grandfathered with the current net metering scheme for 20 years, and that's the life of most systems. But going forward, customers who get solar will only be guaranteed the same rates for 10 years. And this was one of the biggest points of contention for those in the solar industry, like Lewis Wolfenden. He works for a local installer in Tucson called Net Zero Solar.
10 years is often kind of a psychological point where people are willing to invest their money if they're going to get it back in that time. But if they don't know what's going to happen beyond 10 years, that can sometimes be a tough value proposition.
And that's because when people buy or lease their systems, it takes a while for them to get a return on their investment, of course. Now, there's some disagreement about what that payback period is, but Wolfenden and others say, factoring in some other possible rate changes, that it's probably going to be longer than 10 years, and people will be more reluctant to invest in these systems because their rates could change before they've gotten their return.
So the rooftop solar industry not thrilled with this decision. Was everybody upset?
There were a couple local solar businesses that said that they'll adapt, but in general, you're right. The rooftop solar industries, the big players, companies like Sunrun, were not happy. Of course, on the flip side, other parties like the utilities were pretty pleased with the decision. Utilities like APS say that this will deal with some of the growing cost shift created by rooftop solar onto non-solar customers. Remember, that's the real genesis of this whole debate. Solar customers say the benefits are not really being fully valued. The utilities say, actually, this is a subsidy and you're shifting costs onto other customers. The final decision was a 4-1 vote, and Chairman Doug Little said it was a historic step forward, but he also admitted that there are so many issues here, it's so complex that not everyone is going to be happy.
So what happens next now?
The vote doesn't actually trigger any immediate changes. It's more of like a guiding policy decision that will be used to nail down the exact numbers and details in upcoming rate cases. Next year, we'll have rate cases for Arizona Public Service and Tucson Electric Power. And those also contain rate changes and rate hikes for all customers, not just solar. So we'll really see how this all gets ironed out during those each specific rate case next year.
That's KJZZ's Will Stone on changes to net metering policy. Will, thanks.
Thanks, Mark.
Tucson voters this spring will be asked to increase their taxes to pay for public safety and roads. The city council last night unanimously approved sending that question to the ballot in a May special election. The half-cent sales tax increase would bring in an estimated $50 million a year for the 5 years it would be in effect. With me to talk about this is City Councilman Steve Kozacik. And Steve, why does Tucson need this extra money?
Well, fundamentally, we have to start taking care of our own needs, our capital needs. We've been looking for the state to provide HERF money or LTAF money. They keep sweeping it or reducing the amount.
That's transportation money.
That's right, yeah. And we have a local regional transportation authority that only builds to add capacity, and they do not have a maintenance component to it. So the needs are just fundamentally large, and we have to take care of it ourselves. And so we do not have a general fund capacity. These needs are not going to go away. They are hundreds of millions of dollars worth of needs citywide, much less region-wide. And as far as the public safety vehicles are concerned, we haven't bought public safety vehicles since the recession. And if you see a paramedic truck driving past you in the city of Tucson, the chances are 8 out of 10 that the thing has over 150,000 miles on it. And about 3/4 of our police cars are beyond their useful life. So we simply have to do this, Mark, and it's long due.
It sounds like there was some debate last night over how to allocate where the money would go. Are you satisfied with what the final result will be?
Well, I would have chosen a different option. I would have skewed the weighting more heavily in favor of roads. But I think that there's value in the community, seeing that the mayor and the council are all in on this together. And so I supported the allocation. It's going to go 60% public safety, 40% roads. The other reason that I think that that's important is because our community is just weary of seeing the city and the county sniping it at each other and the outlying areas fighting with one another. We need to recognize that the roads in the city of Tucson, and there are close to 2,000 linear miles of them, all of the regional residents drive on them. And so this is a regional issue. And so for the surrounding region to see the local mayor and council of the city of Tucson to be unified in this, it sends a message to them as well that they need to be supportive of this.
This is a tax that my understanding is that would sunset after 5 years. Are you satisfied that that is enough time to raise the amount of money that you need to raise to do the projects you need to do?
No, it's not going to be, and that was another area that I was in disagreement on. The RTA, Regional Transportation Authority, is going to have to go back to the legislature to get reauthorized because they sunset in 2025. My argument to the mayor and council was, let's not pretend that number one, that this state legislature is going to reauthorize a tax, and number two, is going to reauthorize a doubling of the RTA tax, which is what they're talking about doing, so that they have the capacity to do maintenance. I would have much preferred going to the voters and saying, let's not sunset at least the road component of this, because let's not kid ourselves, 5 years from now, we will not have fixed the roads. The consensus on the council, though, was, or the majority in the council, was that let's sunset it, let's give the RTA a chance at the legislature, and let's see how those chips fall. But quite honestly, Mark, we're going to be back in front of the voters in 5 years asking to do this again. I would have preferred to have the conversation one time, call it good. We're identifying a permanent funding source for our roads. Public safety is okay to sunset in 5 or 7 years because we will purchase the vehicles and then we'll be good to go going forward. And in fact, the reason I argued for a permanent quarter-cent sales tax for allocated towards the roads was because once we fix them all, in air quotes, we'll be ready to go back and start fixing the ones that we're fixing with the dollars now. And so I would have preferred this be permanent. It's not 5 years. Okay, we'll go back and have this conversation 5 years from now, assuming the voters approve this in May.
That's Tucson City Councilman Steve Kozacik. We were talking about the council's decision last night to ask voters to approve a half-cent sales tax increase to pay for public safety and roads. That vote is scheduled for May.
Let's talk about rain. It's kind of a big deal across the Southwest. This week we've been talking about how citizens can contribute to the understanding of science and nature. And one way that happens is in how rainfall amounts are captured around the state. From the Arizona Science Desk, Sarah Hammond reports for KJZZ.
Rain, Hundreds of people in Arizona voluntarily keep an eye on rainfall totals in their yards and report them to a database used by utilities, government agencies, gardeners, researchers, even weather geeks. Each rain logger is a citizen scientist. The University of Arizona-based RainLog program started more than 15 years ago to collect rainfall data around the upper San Pedro River in Cochise County. Water resource expert Gary Woodard is one of the founders.
Some of the researchers came to me and said, we need a way for volunteers to report rainfall in the Sierra Vista area. They thought maybe 8 or 10 folks that could report it weekly.
Within a couple of years, more than 500 people in Pima County had backyard gauges. They were joined by 350 in Maricopa County and clusters in other parts of the state and country. Woodard says the numbers are now down a bit. The program has limited funding and is promoted largely by word of mouth.
Some people do not report every day when it doesn't rain, but some people report every single day. Other people mostly just when it does rain. The reports just pour in the morning after an active monsoon day.
The database can be manipulated to show rainfall by individual weather event, by year, or cumulatively. Martha Ritalik has been recording rainfall data at her Central Tucson home for more than 5 years.
I like statistics. I like data.
In addition to the hundreds of people who record data on the website, thousands of others benefit by registering as rain mappers. Each gets an email when rainfall in their surrounding area has been recorded. Margaret McIntosh is one of those weather watchers. McIntosh says she has been recording rainfall totals since she moved to Tucson in 1994. If she's away, she relies on RainLog to fill in the blanks.
If I'm not sure what I got in my rain gauge, how accurate that is, or I was out of town when there was a rain event, I check rainlog.org to see what the people in my neighborhood who are reporting rainfall have reported.
McIntosh is an ecologist who is studying an endangered cactus in the Waterman Mountains near Tucson. She says her team's research would benefit if there were rain loggers near the study area.
I sort of wish there was somebody who had a house out at the end of the Avra Valley Road who had a rain gauge and was reporting to RainLog, because then we would have closer data.
Woodard says he is pleased that RainLog is used for a variety of purposes.
What really caught me by surprise was the variety of groups and individuals that started using the data for purposes we never imagined.
Woodard remembers a call he received from an attorney who had to prove that it had rained at a particular intersection in Tucson on a specific day. The official rain gauge at Tucson International Airport had recorded no rain that day, but RainLog's data told a different story.
The State Department of Environmental Quality has a number of Superfund sites and other locations where there's been pollution in the past. And if they get a certain amount of rain, they have to go out and take water samples, test the quality of the runoff from these sites, and they rely on RainLog to figure out if it actually rained near some of these sites.
In Tucson, I'm Sarah Hammond.
We've seen a little bit of the wet stuff around the valley this week, and more is in the forecast, but when high temperatures are in the 60s and 70s, the wet stuff is rain. So what are you supposed to do if you want a white Christmas? You may turn to someone like Nolan DeGraff, who is president of Ice Now. This time of year, the company provides snow for large events, including one at the Arizona Science Center next week. Nolan, how does this work? Where does the snow come from?
We take large amounts of ice, and we have specialty machines that are more like a wood chipper, but they're geared towards ice. And we crush the ice into a powder and at a high rate of speed, typically around 2,500 RPMs. And we shoot the snow out through a hose, and we're able to spray it in a lifelike snow fashion, how it falls from the sky, or we can spray it in a way to where we're able to create sled hills and different snow scenes.
What kind of water is used for it? Does it vary? Is it reused water? Is it wherever the water comes from?
You know, we actually use our City of Phoenix water. That it is a filtered water. We put it through our ice machines just like any other cocktail ice or party ice. So we don't use any reclaimed water because it goes through all of our same process to be able to make the ice. So I wouldn't be able to use anything that wasn't food grade or filtered, because it does use the same equipment.
Is it becoming more widespread, more accepted?
It is becoming more widespread and accepted, and if we're able to make it more affordable as well, then of course the group that we can sell to, it does grow. It is different because we also operate in Las Vegas as well, and it's not a huge thing in Las Vegas, believe it or not, with all the parties and events. It's just Phoenix. I think it's more mature snow market, if that makes any sense. But it is kind of unique, but I think more people are getting, as social media grows and we're able to share it online. I mean, we do have social media campaigns, and it does tend to be shared a lot.
That's Nolan DeGraff of Ice Now, which provides snow for events in the Valley and Las Vegas this time of year. We reached out to SRP to find out whether in the desert wasting water via snowmaking is a concern. Jeff Lane told us there isn't much impact.
I think the amount of snow that's used in some of these parties, holiday parties, is very little overall impact on what, the amount of water that we deliver in Phoenix. It's a great opportunity for kids to get out there and experience different kind of water for them that they usually aren't in, here in the Valley.
If you want to catch a bit of the real stuff, parts of northern Arizona are expected to see snow this week, including today, and there's a 70% chance of the white stuff falling on Christmas Eve.
I, Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
I, Harry S. Truman, do solemnly
swear. Dwight D. Eisenhower, do solemnly swear.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
And will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect,
and defend the Constitution of the United States.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
A new president usually comes into office with a dose of optimism. They see positive public approval ratings during the honeymoon period of the first few months, and then that tends to drop. Presidents need support to get anything done. That's how this system of government was designed. But that's getting harder to do. The show's Annika Klein explores what's so tough about that spot in the Oval Office through the lens of a computer game.
Executive Command was developed by a nonprofit called iCivics, and I sat in with some pros to watch how it's played.
Basically, you're acting as president.
Amelia Swiderski is in Michael Johnson's 8th grade social studies class at Frontier Elementary School.
You have 100% public approval rating.
Yeah.
You know that's like unheard of in real life?
Well, I feel pretty good being president right now on this game.
What's your agenda?
It's youth, so working for the people under 18.
A trip to Congress and a good speech helps promote that agenda.
Obviously, they like the security idea so far. I have to go back to Congress.
Tommy Arnold is trying to get Congress to focus on homeland security policy while juggling a bunch of other bills the public wants to see passed or vetoed.
Right now, my inbox is pretty full.
The point of the game is to give students a sense of how the executive branch operates. Granted, the game poses questions that are pretty black and white, like whether people who can't pay their taxes should instead pay with a well-crafted song and dance. But Arnold says it's giving him an idea of just how tough the real job is.
It's probably hard because everything relies on you. You have to make the right decisions, and if you mess up, everyone hates you, basically.
It's always been a tough job.
Matthew Dickinson is a professor of political science at Middlebury College. He writes about the presidency and how it works.
One of the great difficulties that presidents face is the frustration that comes with realizing, to a certain extent, they've been handed a scepter of leadership that, is only sporadically effective. It's the illusion of power.
Illusion being the key word here. Remember what Arnold said?
It's probably hard because everything relies on you.
Dickinson says this is the perception a lot of the public holds. But the ability to make big changes during a presidential term is diminishing as government becomes more and more divided along party lines. Decades ago, he says, the president could reach across the aisle and grab more support for an idea.
But over the course of 40 years, parties have shed their non-conforming members. There are very few liberal Republicans. There's very few conservative Democrats. And so the only way you can get things done is to rely on your own party, and that just seems to send the wrong message to the public.
So Arnold's second assumption is spot on. People get really frustrated. They vote one party out of office, hoping the other will bring the change they want to see. This is what the game is trying to instill in students. You only win at being president if you make both Congress and the people happy. Oh, and those other foreign powers, too.
And now we're in war, basically.
Do you think this messes with your security agenda?
Yeah, a little bit, just because I have other stuff to do.
Arnold's teacher, Michael Johnson, says in the end, it's not so much about which choices they make or which opinions they have.
The main thing is I encourage my students to think and be able to support their opinions. Whatever your opinion is, you have to be able to justify and support what you believe.
Even if you definitely won't get 100% public approval in real life. For the show, I'm Annika Klein.
Collaboration among cities around the valley and across the state is seen as a key toward making the area more competitive in the regional and national economies. The East Valley Partnership plays a role in that, but it's also been carving its own growing niche over the past 35 years. And this week, the EVP held its PHX East Valley Economic Forum with a look ahead to the future. John Lewis, former Gilbert mayor, is president and CEO of the East Valley Partnership. And John, changes have been obvious over the past 35 years, but what has stood out to you?
35 years ago, the population of this region we're calling the PHX East Valley was probably about 200, maybe approaching 250,000. And today we're approaching 1.4 million. So we've grown over a million. And we anticipate that in another 30, 35 years, we'll add another million people in the southeast part of the valley. In the last 35 years, there has been a lot of advocacy for topics such as education, transportation, some specifics on industries such as aerospace. It all kind of ties into quality of life and why would people want to be in this area. And so that will continue. Some of the emphasis that we would have right now would continue to be on education and transportation. A lot of our businesses have said it's hard in Arizona to find venture capital money. So we're also looking at and strategizing about how we could do that in the future.
Regionalism is a big word that comes up a lot. East Valley Partnership obviously has to figure out what it's going to do for its members and for that particular region. And yet, where does the fit come when it comes to, yes, we need to benefit our region, but then there's the greater region to talk about as well, which one would think, at least philosophically, people have to be as close to being on the same page as possible, though it's not going to be perfect.
It was a great experience to be the mayor of Gilbert. And I'm kind of now known as Citizen John. And yet I go back to, from a mayor perspective, in any of the communities when you're trying to improve economic development, you realize that we have to sell, and this would be for businesses outside of Arizona, you have to sell Arizona first. Then you sell a region such as Greater Phoenix, and then maybe another region, whether it's West Valley or East Valley, and then you get inside of the local small municipality. So mayors realize that if an Intel goes to Chandler, and I'm in Gilbert, that is a huge win for the state of Arizona, for Greater Phoenix, for our PHX East Valley, and for Gilbert, even though it might have been located in Chandler, because a lot of those future employees will live in the Gilbert area and they'll have high-wage jobs and support the local economy. And so when we bring up education, if we're talking to businesses that are here first and they want to grow, they need a strong workforce. We're talking to businesses outside of Arizona. They want an area that has a strong workforce. So the tie of education to economic development is very strong. Education is such a key factor in selling an area that the leadership of Greater Phoenix, of our specific areas, realize that that is a key to make sure it's very strong and will be in the future, so that businesses will have a strong workforce and they'll have a quality of life where families will say, this is where we want to live because education is strong.
So I'll ask you this as Citizen John now, but you were a former mayor, so you have been on both sides of this. When it comes to making this sort of progress, how much of it is about government policy? How much of it is about business leaders taking hold? And how much of it is sometimes people just have to compromise?
The government policy definitely has a big impact. And 2009 is when I started the mayor assignment, and I was really involved with when site selectors would come from outside the state of Arizona to see how they would rank Arizona to other states. We were struggling at that point with some of our tax policy. A lot of things have happened that have made Arizona very competitive. Right now, what I hear from companies outside of Arizona often is some concerns about education. And so there are some policies still that the government can be involved with. I also emphasize that from a culture standpoint, it is important for what I would call parental involvement. A strong educational system, especially in K-12. The summary of your question, government policy is a key factor, important. Individual educational leaders, and then right down at the home level, the parents are key to success.
John Lewis is CEO of East Valley Partnership. This week, the group had its PHX East Valley Economic Forum. You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
I'm Kayla, and we were taking a carriage ride to spend some good family time together to celebrate the holidays. We went around the block and we got to see all the lights, and it's magical. There are lights on every tree and everything's moving and glittering, and it looks like a winter wonderland.
Her name was Grace.
Was she pretty?
Mm-hmm.
Good girl.
And it was fun that we got to wave to people.
Kind of felt like princesses, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whoa.
All right, next family.
I haven't done it before, but I know that there's a lot of people that make this a really big tradition, and I'm really glad I got to be part of it this time.
That's Kayla Pincher along with Kaylee Ray riding in a horse-drawn carriage through downtown Glendale. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just want to send us a sugar cube, send us a note, the show at kjzz.org.
It's the show on 91.5. Thanks for listening this afternoon. I'm Mark Brody.
And with John Hockenberry at the Takeaway, I'm Steve Goldstein. The manhunt is still underway in Germany for a Tunisian man suspected to have carried out Monday's truck attack at a Christmas market in Berlin.
The profile of the suspect represents a political problem for the German government and invites criticism of Chancellor Angela Merkel's immigration policies.
Constanze Delzenmuller is a senior fellow with the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. Constanze, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
Do you think this attack is a turning point in modern German history in the sense that we've been moving forward uninterrupted on this embrace of migrants and sort of the open Germany policy, and this is all of a sudden a possible setback?
You know, I think that's wildly overburdening the interpretation of this event. It's certainly a milestone in that it was the first major terrorist attack in modern German history, but honestly, both the authorities in Germany and the German public knew that at some point this was going to happen. In an open society with many, many soft targets that you can't defend without making them completely, you know, closing them off and closing off society, this, I think many people had a feeling of inevitability.
So there's enough political preparation for this event to stay the course and to keep moving forward, even regardless of the criticism of Angela Merkel particularly.
Look, I mean, it's obvious that all of Merkel's enemies within her own party, within the Bavarian sister party, CSU, those being her rivals, are her political real enemies, and they're in right-wing and left-wing populist parties, that they're trying to blame this on her one particularly egregious tweet called the deaths of these people killed by the truck on Monday. The Merkel's dead. I mean, that's scandalous, but it's also wrong. I think most Germans felt that, surprised and concerned that the German state, the German institutions seemed so overwhelmed by the migrant influx. But the reality is that this influx has trickled down to manageable numbers. The ones that have arrived have been distributed. And there's an ongoing, if slow and somewhat chaotic, process of returning people, or to not use a euphemism, deporting them if they haven't gotten asylum status. One of the problems with the Tunisian guy, who's now the main suspect in this attack, is that he had no papers and that the Tunisian authorities in his home state had been slow in supplying them, and thus was slowing down the deportation process.
What do you think about the public appreciation or criticism of the investigation that's gone on? Is this a collision of security policy and a sense of wanting not to be living in a state where there's surveillance constantly? Is there a discussion of changing the rules?
You know, again, I honestly think it's important to not overinterpret this. I am living in D.C., but I am often in Berlin. I have many, many friends there. I lived there for 10 years before I moved here. And from what I see of my friends and acquaintances' postings on Facebook and elsewhere, the mood is pretty calm and not all that critical. Yes, it's true that Germans dislike surveillance cameras. Half of the country, or let's say 4/10 of the country, the former East Germany, you know, until 1989, lived in a state of constant surveillance. You can understand why that's not culturally particularly popular. I think that that might change. I think we might have a, you know, reinforcement of police and domestic intelligence, but that was well underway, and it's been well underway, frankly, since the attacks of 9/11 and the kind of international collaboration that was created at the time.
So the suspicion would be that Angela Merkel will run for re-election next year. Is that still up in the air?
She's already said she would several weeks ago. I have mixed feelings about this. I have great admiration for her. I think she's been a very strong and good chancellor. But fourth terms, you know, Americans don't like dynasties, whether they're called Bush or Clintons. And in Germany, fourth term attempts have usually not ended well. Germans are as keen to preserve democracy and political change as other Western democracies.
Would you say that a change in the leadership in Berlin would change Germany's role as leader in this Europe project that is so in turmoil since Brexit?
That's really hard to say. She's one of the European Union's staunchest defenders. And perhaps for American listeners, the reason why we feel so strongly about this is that most of us have parents or grandparents who have memories of the war, who have, you know, made an effort for reconciliation with a people tormented, killed, massacred by our Nazi ancestors. And we have borders with 9 other countries in Europe. For us, it's unimaginable to live in a Europe where all the borders are pulled up again and where people don't talk to each other. This is about peace, prosperity, stability, and yes, democratic transformation, including in my own country. And so I have a hard time thinking that somebody who replaced Merkel, whether at the elections in 2017 or at any other point, you know, would feel any differently about this project unless that person was a populist. And for this point, at this point, I don't see Germans electing a populist as the next chancellor. I'm happy to say that I think we can safely exclude that.
Constanze Stelzenmüller is the Robert Bosch Senior Fellow with the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. Well, it'll be very interesting to see what wild cards are in the deck in the German elections as that transpires over the next several months. Constanze, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
The governor's Office of Youth, Faith, and Families is touting the results of a drug prevention pilot program called Healthy Families, Healthy Youth. It's geared towards 7th graders, and the agency worked with one middle school in each county on it. The program consists of a 2.5-hour back-to-school night for students, parents, teachers, and others in an effort to get everyone on the same prevention page. With me to talk about this is Debbie Moak, director of the governor's Office of Youth, Faith, and Family. And Debbie, how is this curriculum, which your office helped write, different from other drug prevention programs in schools like DARE?
Yes, this program is different in several ways. Number one, it's very peer-based, making the program very relatable to each of the respective audiences. The other way this program is so unique is typically we see programs where you educate one or the other, either the students or the parents or the faculties. In this case, we were educating all of them in one evening. And the third reason I would tell you it was so unique is we know that the number one way to help prevent youth substance use is through parent conversation, parent boundaries. And this program has the parent and child conclude the evening by sitting down together and writing a one-year drug prevention plan. And they talk to each other.
As you know, 7th graders and teenagers in general can be, you know, kind of jaded when it comes to things like this. How did you try to get around that and really have them listen and not think, you know, this is hokey, I don't need to know this, that sort of thing?
Yes, and the answer to that was the uniqueness of the program through peer-based education. Some of the preliminary survey data that we've received is 98% of the youth said, I am confident I can avoid drugs and alcohol in the coming year. They also said, and this is remarkable, if you think about that age, 94% of the youth said, I had an honest conversation about drugs and alcohol with an adult. That is huge in my world.
Do you find that parents generally know what to say when they talk to their kids about drugs and alcohol?
I find the opposite of that. They generally don't know what to say. By and large, kids want to have this conversation, as do their parents. But there is a huge disconnect. This program was designed specifically to be a bridge for that disconnect.
You referenced some of the positive results that you got based on some of the data that you've seen so far from students. How do you make sure that you try to continue that and it doesn't just end with sort of writing up a drug prevention plan, but that actually goes into effect?
So we're doing a 90-day follow-up. We want to make sure that the program has, I call it, stickiness. So we'll have more data to come. As well, remember that we do continue through our agency to fund many coalitions and nonprofits and work with them. They are embedded in many of Arizona's schools, and they will stay and continue the work.
It seems like we hear quite a bit anymore about schools sort of having a problem getting parents involved in the classroom, having them come to things and sort of be involved in their kids' educations. Did you find during this process that parents were able to be invested in this and came to it and were really present while they were there?
Yes. You've just identified the biggest challenge. Do I want to say we need to make more progress as we continue to roll this out next year? We do. But I think by word of mouth, because this program was so highly evaluated by parents, students, and faculty, there's a lot of buzz, if you will, around it. And schools, a few of our pilot schools last year actually rolled out a second evening. And as well, we have schools that were already saying to us, hey, I've got, you know, three other middle schools. When can I take this to my other schools? They're anxious to roll this out. So we're looking to scale it.
Yeah. Do you expect to have more of this, to expand it? You mentioned you're in all 15 counties, but do you expect to have it in more schools in the next school year?
So the current plan is we believe we will be able to double next year to 30 schools. But do I think that's enough? No.
What's the impediment to expanding it further? Is it a lack of money? Is it something else?
It's always funding. It's always funding.
How much does a program like this cost?
So the good news about this program is it's exceedingly affordable compared to some other programs. So again, I think long term, we've got something really good here. Again, I don't want to oversell, but the preliminary data, it's very promising.
Debbie Moak is the director of the Governor's Office of Youth, Faith, and Family. Debbie, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Raindrops on roses and whiskers on kittens, bright copper kettles and warm woolen mittens,
brown paper packages tied up with strings.
These are a few of my favorite things.
2016 has been a really tough year for many people. So as the year draws to a close, we wanted to take a minute to celebrate a few things we loved from this year in a series called My Favorite Things. Joining me now to talk about her favorite music of the year is KJZZ's resident music maven, Sarah Ventry. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Steve.
So, Sarah, what did you love this year?
Well, there was a lot to love, but for me, by far, the biggest album of the year was from Queen Bee. It was, of course, Beyoncé's Lemonade.
Hold up, they don't love you like I love you. Slow down, they don't love you like I love you. Back up, they don't love you like I love you. Step down, they don't love you like I love you.
Can't you see there's no other man above you? What a wicked way to treat the girl that loves you. Oh, love, they don't love you like I love you. Oh, don't, they don't love you like I love you.
This was one of, if not the most talked about, written about Complex albums made probably in the last 10 years. It premiered as a visual album, which is sort of like an extended artistic music video, but for the whole album. So the visual album aired on a Sunday night. And by the time I woke up on Monday morning, my Facebook feed was completely flooded with think pieces about it. There is so much there to unpack. So over the course of the album, she discloses that Jay-Z cheated on her, and she really walks through her process of grief and kind of her way of processing that. So she deals with a lot of complex themes that are both deeply personal, but also things that are much bigger than that, things that we're kind of talking about in the world right now. So she deals with themes of forgiveness, but also social justice, race, identity, gender. It's done so brilliantly and carefully and meticulously, but it's also just an amazing album with really powerful music and visuals that I think is going to hold up for a really long time. And it's going to be one of those records that, like, in 10 years, when we look back at albums that kind of defined this year and defined this time, this is definitely going to be one of those albums.
Okay, so if anyone knows you at all, we're not surprised you love Beyoncé so much. But what about locally? What was your favorite album from Arizona this year?
Well, there were a lot of really great records by local bands this year, too. In fact, New Times put out a list of the 40 best albums by local bands this year. But for me, there was one Arizona album in particular that I just couldn't stop listening to. It was Orquesta Mendoza's Vamos a Guarachar. So every time I tell myself, okay, I'm going to take this out of the rotation in my car, I just kind of can't. It's it's high energy. It's stylistically very diverse. There's rock, cumbia, mambo, psych, all kinds of stuff on this record. And in some ways, it sounds kind of like a milieu of Arizona to me. Maybe it's not representative of everything happening in the state, but you hear a lot of different things that are happening here. And I heard one translation of the album title as We're Gonna Get Down, which is what I personally really want to hear at the end of this year.
And you interviewed Sergio Mendoza, the leader of the band, when the album came out.
I did. And one thing he said that I really loved was that there's a song on this album called Redoble that sounds like a party song, but it's actually about his experiences with racism. And the word Redoble also means drum fill. So he says, like, the drum fill kind of leads you to the next section in the music, but he also sees it as a change. So the phrase he says in that song, Vamos a Guarachar, which is also the album title, is kind of like an invitation to people to dance and to celebrate with one another. And there's sort of a message of change in there. And I just really love the layers of meaning in this album. Plus, I just want to get up and dance like every time I hear it.
Sarah, were there any trends or styles of music you noticed having an especially good year in 2016?
Yes, there is this really cool music coming out of the Saharan Desert right now that I am totally obsessed with. And there are a handful of artists from that region that released new albums this year. Many of them were just spectacular. So one that I also can't seem to remove from my car stereo rotation right now is a band from southern Algeria called Imarhan. This style of music is often called desert rock or desert blues here in the West, but in that part of the world, it's known as asuf, which is a very complex cultural concept that doesn't really translate. From what I understand, it kind of relates to solitude and loneliness and homesickness, and actually a feeling of being alone in the desert. The members of Imarhan are young, they're in their 20s, and they describe their music as kind of a new experience of asuf. So you can hear, like, there's lots of energy. I think
when I hear this, sometimes I almost hear elements that remind me of like 70s rock music from the US. They have this very virtuosic guitar playing, these gorgeous vocal harmonies. And then they also use some traditional elements in their music, like, for example, this instrument called the calabash, which is a hollowed out dried gourd that's played as a percussive instrument.
And is there anything else coming out from that part of the world that you loved as well?
Yes, there is a Mauritanian musician named Noura Mint Somali. She has one of the most amazing voices in the world right now, and she makes this gorgeous psychedelic desert music. She released a new album this year called Arbina. Doesn't it just kind of like sweep you away?
Yeah.
So Noura Mint Somali plays a traditional Mauritanian instrument called the ardeen, and her husband is her guitarist. I saw her earlier this year at South by Southwest, and people went nuts. Like, this was definitely one of my favorite records of the year.
And speaking of South by Southwest, you went out, you saw a lot of shows. What was the favorite live performance you saw this year?
It was actually another show at South by Southwest, and it was Iggy Pop.
Now, he is a unique guy. What is he like on stage?
Oh, my God. He was just what you would expect. He was raw and magnetic and all over the place. So he came out on stage shirtless with a black jacket on, unbuttoned. And by the second or third song, the jacket had already come off. He was flirting with people in the audience. He sounded amazing. It was just loud and powerful. You know, he's almost 70 and he has like no signs of slowing down. And I was just so drawn in. Like, you know, when you see a really great show and you kind of feel like you're in like something of a fever, like you can feel all this energy coursing through you. It's really hard to contain it. You kind of can't stand still. It was like that for the entire show. My only regret was not being close enough to the stage to help catch him when he stage dived multiple times.
That was KJZZ's Sarah Ventry talking about her favorite music of the year, and we'll be talking with other community members about their favorite things from 2016 in the next couple of weeks. Sarah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.